Welcome to the coveted 10 a.m. on Sunday slot. I'd like all of you to open your hymnals to page 35, please. My name is Blair Chintella. I'm an attorney. I live in the Atlanta area. I have a general practice, and I focus on my personal life more so than professional issues of surveillance and civil liberties. I've been following these issues for approximately 6-7 years now. So I have pretty extensive knowledge about these issues, and they're very important, I think, in my opinion. So,
and as I said, I'm Scott Jones, and I'm a software developer and an IT kind of person. And I think back in the mid 90s, I was aware of the kind of issues that the Electronic Frontier Foundation got started under, and some of the some of the cyber liberties kind of issues that were coming up, and I was just frustrated and not really knowing what I could do. And so I joined a group called Electronic Frontiers Georgia. That's an independent group. It's not a chapter of the EFF. It's an independent group with similar ideas and similar ideals. And what came out of that was DragonCon and all this. And so this whole program was a part of that. And so, you know, that's kind of why we're here today. Getting back to the UK Investigatory Powers Bill, what we're talking about today, yeah, there's been a lot of concern about what's going on in America, what's going on in the U.S. As we make these decisions between privacy and security, and we find in some ways that Europe is further ahead and going down the dark path a little faster than we are at times. And that's where the great concern lies. And in some ways, they're at the bleeding edge. While we're still having the debate, they're going ahead and marching forward and doing some things that are rather scary to us. You see these kind of situations where sometimes Europe tries to lead us in a particular direction. And even in our own country, sometimes California tries to lead us in a particular regulatory direction by being the first to pass a certain kind of law. So, you know, as we continue to scratch our heads and decide, you know, even in this election, I think the election coming up will set some directions as to where we go versus, you know, privacy versus security. Those issues are brewing hot and heavy in Europe and in the UK. And, we're going to meet these head on probably sooner than we realize. So we have a lot of tough decisions to make. It's a lot to think about, and there's a lot of scary implications as we go down this path.
Yeah, I concur. This is, you know, serious issues involving privacy and security that unfortunately a lot of the times we don't get to address because the government just takes action that it views it has without really consulting the public. So these types of panels and these issues, you know, are really important to keep going for a democracy, actually. So the issue here is the Investigatory Powers Bill, which is a piece of legislation in the United Kingdom. Several years ago, the head of the UK government announced that they were going to come up with some, you know, all-encompassing legislation to revise their surveillance powers. And this is what they came up with, and it was announced last year in November, I believe. And I'm just going to kind of go through some of the main provisions, and if anyone has any questions at any time, please feel free, because there's not that many people here, so I'll have a discussion.
Raise your hand. So we
raise
can
your hand.
The
yes.
Microphone out.
Yeah. And we'll toss you the microphone. So some of the things that the initial bill proposed, I'll go through those. But what happened after the initial announcement of it was that there was a big uproar with the civil liberties community and various UK legislators and whatnot. And now it's in committee and it's going to be amended, you know, supposedly and whatnot. So, but initially the bill creates an investigatory powers commission that basically consolidates all the supervision of any sort of surveillance. So right now it's divided up into different agencies and different authorities, but this would basically kind of centralize that power. And there would be a head judge. It would be similar to the FISA court, is my understanding. If you're aware, the FISA court is a secretive court here in the United States that reviews certain types of warrants and whatnot. So Would be very similar to that. So I would envision that it would play out the same way, where a lot of the requests are just kind of rubber stamped or granted or whatnot. So that would be the primary concern there, is like, what supervision of the supervisory body would we have? What access would we have to this information, considering that the requests they're going to get obviously have confidential information in them? So maybe we'll get a redacted opinion or something. That's about it. But other than that, you know, what are we going to get? What will the UK citizens get? And I'll explain how this legislation could possibly affect Americans in a little bit. But it would require communication service providers to keep records of your web browsing history and other records for 12 months. So some jurisdictions in Europe already have this requirement for a certain period of time. Some communication service providers or ISPs will maintain records for a certain period of time just of their own volition, but this would actually require companies to maintain all those records for 12 months, and then the government can basically obtain those records upon certain requests, which do not rise to the level of a warrant with probable cause in certain circumstances. And there are tiers of the type of information that they maintain, and their requirements are typically more stringent for the more personal information, but even at the most personal information, it doesn't rise to probable cause. It's basically a certification from the secretary that it's proportional and necessary. So if you've ever talked to a politician or a lawyer like myself, and you ask them what proportional and necessary means, you can use your imagination about how broad that's going to be. So that's another issue with that, that it's not really, they're talking about in the legislation to also have a double lock system, which is basically their fancy way of saying a judge is also going to sign off on it. But again, it's simple. It's similar to the FISA court in that connection. It has massive expansion of sharing of information, so local police agencies can share information. Again, it's somewhat tiered in that local police agencies can't necessarily get your browsing history. Intelligence agencies can, police can't. But so there's going to be some specifications about that, who gets what, who has authority to get what. But overall, there's gonna be a massive increase in the sharing of the information. It places a legal obligation on communication service providers to assist. The initial draft of the bill actually forced them to employ their facilities. So if you were at the FBI versus panel yesterday, it would basically require internet service providers to assist in that endeavor. Also, companies would be required to assist, so like Apple, Yahoo, Google, their Android products and whatnot. The initial version would require them to decrypt, which would basically take care of the situation with between the FBI and Apple that happened here in the United States. So that would actually become a requirement, or else they'd be breaking the law. So it raises a whole bunch of questions about how can they even do business in the UK. And how can they tell their customers that their information is safe in the UK? Which is really sad, because if you think about the UK, you think of it as a Western democracy. You think of it as this, you know, the West, the good guys versus the bad guys who believe in surveillance. And, you know, but there, you know, there are a bunch of polls that show the index of, like, freedom from a variety of factors, you know, whether it be property rights, financial matters, civil liberties, you know, free speech, whatever, and they put it in an index and they analyze all those factors and they come up with a score. Again, this is statistics, so you could argue that, you know, the methodology isn't perfect or whatnot, but a variety of sources show UK going way down. So they're going way down as far as the national or international competition, I like to think of it, for privacy and civil liberties. You know, I think that we should look at it like that, because civil liberties and privacy have to have a higher priority than they have. I don't think security should always trump. So I think we have to be focused on, you know, that should be a competition. That should be a goal of ours to compete in that regard. And then having that friendly competition is going to raise the bar, raise it for everyone. People will have creativity and come up with new ways to achieve that and still maintain our security. But if you're focused on the other thing, which is security all the time, completely focused on that, then you're going to get that. You're just going to get that. You're not going to get a full thought out process that incorporates the privacy beliefs as well. Anyways, get off my soapbox for a while if you have.
Well, I would say as a technologist, that, you know, one of the things I've noticed about today's technologies is they're either very, very open or very, very closed. And there's just not really anything in the middle. You know, if you install a back door, there's really, I think this is something that legislators and policy people struggle with, that they don't understand with the technology. If you install a back door to anything, then there's no technology out there that can tell the good guys from the bad guys 100% of the time. So once that door is open, and it's hard to secure it against each and every comer. So you're faced with kind of a tough choice, that you need to either make everything wide open or everything locked down, and each one of those two choices has implications that may be positive, may be negative. But this is something that I think that the average legislator and the average person in law enforcement and the average maybe policy person doesn't quite understand. That it is just the way it is. It's with digital technology today, and it's kind of unprecedented compared to when we go back to like analog phone calls, letters being written by hand, things like that, the older forms of technology. This kind of technology, it's either very, very open or very, very locked down, and there's just not a lot in the middle. It's not like, you know, you've got a letter with the message on the inside and the envelope on the outside. And it's hard to strike a balance in the middle. And I think, you know, there's implications either way. And legislators just haven't wrapped their head around that concept.
Kind of building off of that, legislators don't wrap their heads around that concept, but a lot of the times it's sort of out of their hands. I would just kind of add to that. Oh, question.
When there's time, when there's a break. Oh. Well, I have a couple of things. Why? Hello? Hello? Why do I care about the UK? Why is this important to me? That's, you know, here I'm in this session because I went to the FBI Apple one. I totally get that, why that's important to me, but why is the UK, this snooper's charter, an issue that I need to really be aware of?
Well, it's definitely true that the USA is in a leadership position, that when we have good policy, you know, we try to export democracy, we try to export good policies, but when we set bad policies for ourselves, those also get exported. I think there is a great concern in this country that as Europe goes further down the dark path, that's going to affect at least the arguments back in our court. You know, the Apple phones, they're manufactured in China, but they're designed in the USA. And eventually, from a regulation point of view, if enough countries in Europe mandate a backdoor or mandate whatever, that becomes a requirement here, and it makes things a lot more complicated here. So, you know, do you have to make two kinds of smartphones, one for Europe, one for America, or do they make only one kind of smartphone, and we try to turn off the backdoor feature in America if it isn't required, but somebody finds a way to hack it in? So it does have a ripple effect, I mean, because there's, you know, today we don't make different iPhones for different countries, it's one iPhone, and if those requirements ripple back into, you know, you can say that with any technology. If those requirements ripple back into the U.S. where we design them here, if we have to do them differently for different countries, we can bring in a lot of risk that essentially spreads across the globe. So as soon as you have a critical mass in any one part of the globe, it can affect everybody.
Does that mean the U.K. can decrypt our email then on the iPhone?
Well, if the FBI can't do it, probably the U.K. can't today, but you know, that's the question is tomorrow. This becomes a slippery slope. So if we enable this for any country, then if the UK can do it, then Europe can do it, the US can do it, and eventually China and Russia can do it. They're pretty smart about what they have smart people. And then you just get to the point where everything's wide open to everyone, and that's the problem.
My curiosity would be like, if we're fighting against, you know, against it in the UK, saying, hey, this is wrong, what about in Pakistan, Afghanistan?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a trickle-down effect, and eventually every country is going to want this. Every government already wants this, you know, from a point of view, and they're mad that they can't just pass an edict and make it happen. But the technology is coming from other countries like the USA, and you know, they'd like to be able to snap their fingers and change the technology. It's like Professor Lawrence Lessig said, "Code is law." It's like once you code something in a particular way, you can change the law all you want. It doesn't automatically go back and magically change all the code. It doesn't magically change the device. It's kind of an architectural thing. If you build, you know, when architect, the building regulations change over time. But if you change a building regulation, the old buildings that were built to the old standards don't magically go back and reform to meet that. You know, the old buildings are still there. So this is kind of an architectural issue. We've written our technology to meet the standards of the day. And if we change that tomorrow, the old technology isn't going to go back and change. But we do have a slippery slope looking forward into the future, as, you know, all these changes have potential unintended consequences. And that's where we're concerned, the two of us, and why we're up here, is looking at the unintended consequences as we go forward down this path.
Yeah, I think of it as setting, just basically in common sense terms, you know, setting a bad example. You know, whenever you have kind of a group of people and then a majority of them agree to do a certain course of action, there tends to be a a following about that. So when you have the leaders of a group doing something, which by way of analogy would be like the international community. So in a lot of ways, the UK is a leader in the world. America is a leader in the world. And so we have basic, you know, a lot of ways the ability to control the social norms of the international community. So I think that on a basic level, that you have to view that as a serious responsibility and perpetuate the things. But you can easily get sucked in. There's a temptation, I mean, to get sucked into the easy way out, which is just more and more surveillance, the shortcut, the easy way out. And then it just becomes a downward spiral. So that's just the human nature thing that people struggle with all the time. In small groups, international communities, you know, these governments and our elected leaders are just people like anyone else. So I'd like to keep it on the kind of that level, or think of it as that level, on that level. I can't talk this morning.
I think another thing, another way to look at it is that if you look at the internet technologies from the last 20 years, they've been a profound engine for economic growth. And if we start to pass these kinds of laws that create a chilling effect, I think it's going to create a chilling effect on economic growth too. It's not just about, not an academic argument about our privacy and security. When we start to when we start to restrain ourselves, we start to restrain what we do. This pervasive surveillance can extend beyond the government sector and into the private sector. So, you know, if major company A sees the great innovation from minor company B that could threaten their market, all of a sudden you created a way to get rid of disruptive innovation. And it might be that major company A has connections in the government that lets them spy on their competitors. This is just one example. But if you eliminate the entire system of disruptive innovation, you eliminate the engine that's powered, the economic engine that's really powered the internet revolution for the last 20 years. And so we could get to the point where we, in this era of pervasive surveillance, where we get to a kind of a steady state economy where nothing ever grows and it becomes stagnation. We've seen stagnation in markets. I mean, like, look at what has happened to the broadcast market before internet. It was pretty stagnant. In the music market before the internet, it was pretty stagnant. It was hard to find the growth. And we're headed back on a path that's going back in that direction if we have this pervasive surveillance where you can't have disruptive innovation anymore because everybody knows everything all the time and they can react to you know, prevent competition even.
I was more talking about the inconsistencies, the possibility of inconsistencies in the U.S. U.S. government's, okay, Britain, that's bad, you can't do that. Okay, Afghanistan, you know, that's good, you can do that. Because there's a possibility, higher possibility of somebody attacking the U.S. I mean, I guess it's more on a global scope.
Are you talking about international security as kind of the balancing?
We're talking about the snooper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the U.S. is going, hey, wait a minute, not a good idea. But then what if a dictatorship was passing the same kind of law, or attempting to? Would the U.S. hold the same policy, the same view on it, or would they turn around and say, wait a minute, we like it over here?
Well, I kind of think of that as in general, like, so if, when our country goes to war in certain areas, like let's say Afghanistan, so the stated purpose is to bring freedom and democracy. So I was, you know, if you brainstorm, like, okay, what would that involve? Literally, that means they have freedom of speech and the Bill of Rights. So are we sending our military over there saying, here's the Bill of Rights, we're going to protect these for you? Like, is that what our soldiers are actually doing over there as a practical matter? Imagine if they did that. That would be literally doing what we're saying. But what happens is that we're not, you know, it's like the stated purpose is different than what actually happens. I mean, if we want to bring civil liberties and civil rights, we could apply our constitutional law to another country or something similar. Imagine that. That would be actually consistent with the stated purpose for going over there. So it sort of touches on that same issue of sort of like a double think, that's sort of a cliche term where you can hold the same ideas in your head that conflict. So you think we're bringing liberty to one place when really if you actually delve into it and apply your brain to the thought of whether that's true or not, you'll actually discover that it's not true, literally. There's a contradiction there and it takes some sorting out. You really have to apply yourself sometimes. But there's replete, you know, examples are replete in politics especially, war especially, about that kind of thing. So I think that's kind of what you're talking about. It's inconsistent, yeah. And for searching for the truth, then it's important to notice those inconsistencies. So
I just wanted to switch back to keeping 12 months of the records of your searching. I've been using IxQuick for a couple of years. Is that truly private?
For those who don't know, I believe IxQuick is a search engine that uses Google results, but it acts as an intermediary and it shields all your personal information for the search. As far as I know, it's heralded as secure and anonymizing. So, yeah. Do you know anything about that?
I think you have to ask yourself, what's the worst case scenario? What if they got presented with a national security letter? What if they got presented with, I don't know if they're in the country or not, first of all. What if they got presented in law enforcement? What's the worst thing that could happen? In general, it's probably pretty safe, but it's hard to be 100% sure. And I mean, hopefully they're using HTTPS, which is you've got the little lock icon on your browser and it's secure, so they can't really see what you're going to. But they can, your ISP can certainly see which site that you're going to because it can see the DNS traffic. So unless you're using something like a VPN, it can still the fact that you're using that service can still be tied back to you, even if they can't see the details of what you're searching for. So that's something to be aware of. You can use a combination of VPN and Tor on top of that for additional layer of security to keep it from being to improve your security, to make it harder to tie it back to you. The purpose of Tor is anonymity, not privacy. And you need to keep, there's a subtle distinction between the two, and so you need to keep that in mind. But the privacy should come from the HTTPS, and you would get anonymity from Tor, and you could use VPN to further shield your DNS traffic. If you use the combination of all that, you may sound pretty paranoid, but you know that gives you those multiple layers of protection. If you go onto the EFF.org website, they have a user-friendly discussion of those technologies. So, you know, I suggest trying Tor. I suggest trying a VPN just to become familiar with it and do ordinary stuff with it that you aren't necessarily interested in shielding, just to become comfortable with it. And that provides some extra measure of security, because it's hard to know who's being served with a subpoena these days.
Yeah, different VPNs have different data retention policies as well. Some will swear up and down they don't hold anything. Some will for a short period, or some won't. But it varies and it fluctuates between the VPNs and their services. Generally, the smaller ones afford more privacy. That's the general rule for that. But
I two questions. The first, with respect to the UK charter, is this the piece of legislation that requires companies to give the decryption key to the government? And second, can you compare what's going on with the UK charter with generally what's going on in the EU with respect to that type of legislation?
I don't know as much about the EU, but this bill basically would force the companies to, the original version of the bill, would force the companies to assist in decryption, which as a practical matter would be forcing them to create unencrypted or backdoors, in my opinion. Since that was introduced, there was a big reaction from the civil liberties, and Google, Yahoo, Facebook actually wrote a letter, you know, saying this is a bad idea. The rapporteur on privacy in the EU or UN, I believe, I don't have it in front of me, but he came out against it, saying it was horrible legislation. So what happened is that it was passed the House of Commons, and now it's in a committee, and it's going to be amended similar to our system. So who knows what amendments are going to have. But the Home Secretary, which I understand is similar to our Department of Homeland Security official, not an expert on UK politics, but she came out and said that the revisions they're going to put are going to take into account that and not force decryption. But the language she's using is sort of vague, so it's sort of like if it's not feasible or if it's not overly burdensome. So again, it's one of those terms that lawyers use, you know, is it or is it not overly burdensome? And even if it is overly burdensome, to get that determination is going to cost someone a lot of resources through the judicial process. So the end result, as a practical matter, that's always what it comes down to with these things. First layer, what it says literally, in theory, ooh, sounds good. As a practical matter, that's what happens. Very few people, if you're here about the NSA panel, you could see that hundreds of thousands of NSLs are sent out each year. As a practical matter, because it's so cost inhibitive or prohibitive to challenge them, nobody challenges them. But there's still that, you know, perception or the talking points that you could put out there that it's really good because it has all these measures. So sorry I got off on a tangent there, but I hope that answers your question. The EU, Scott, do you know anything about the...
Yeah, unfortunately I don't know as much about it. I think there was a announcement recently that EU is doing its own thing, and it's hard to know if UK is going to be swept into that because they're leaving the EU, but they haven't really left yet, so it's hard to know how that's all going to mesh out. But EU is doing its own thing, and then as the UK leaves, it's hard to know. I mean, I think that what I'm hearing from the UK Investigatory Powers Bill, it may go beyond what the EU is talking about, but I think the EU is talking about also mandating at least open access to smartphones with the backdoor. I think I read that in the last week or so, and I'm sorry I don't have more specifics on it.
Yeah, I came across a couple of cases the other day. The EU court had ruled that some of the UK laws violated the privacy rights. So in some ways, the EU has some actually above average privacy laws. And so, yeah, the UK... So you have to change your mindset about the UK being this bastion of liberty in the Western democracies in a way. The UK is violating European privacy law now, and according to some court opinions. So the whole Brexit thing, coincidentally, or however you want to put it, is kind of coinciding with that. UK is kind of backing away from the EU. They want to have their privacy laws. They want to have their mass surveillance, and they don't, you know, it's sort of like, you follow us, or else, you know, we're just going to leave. And they're a big economic, what, the biggest one, you said? Biggest part of the EU, as far as I know, economically. So, oh, Germany is? Okay, well, they're top three, I'll say, then.
But so, and we have, you know, Americans have to be reminded that the UKA doesn't necessarily have a Bill of Rights that applies as strongly, and the kind of rights that they have in their society are not as ironclad. So, and I think there is a tendency, if you go back to George Orwell's 1984, which I guess I had to read as a, you know, back as a student, back in my student days. If you go back to that, those tendencies have, even though the technology is very different than today, the tendencies I think have existed in British society for a long time. And that's really what the book is more about, is that tendency to want to go down that path of this feeling, this vague feeling of security in exchange for freedom, liberty, privacy, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what the book is really a warning about.
The other problems with the bill, the three purposes for getting the information in this investigatory powers bill would be national security, the prevention or detection of serious crime. So again, what is serious crime? You know, define that. Or safeguarding the economic well-being of the UK. How much more broader can you get than that? So again, as a practical matter, who's going to challenge that? You know, if it's secret, if the Homeland Secretary signs off on it, and it's a FISA, secret FISA court that approves it, who's going to have a chance to argue what those terms should mean?
Or economic well-being could be, economic spying that has nothing to do with national security. Unfortunately, we know that was happening in America.
Yeah.
Because of the Snowden revelations.
Yep.
I actually have a question. So this kind of ties back with what you all were talking about with Brexit. So, I mean, the Home Office is not a new institution. As far as I understand, it's a pretty old institution in British government. And so now Brexit is apparently happening. There's a small chance it won't, but it, for all intents and purposes, looks like it's going to happen. Could Brexit contain this to the UK and the Commonwealth of Nations, i.e. the British Empire? Could it kind of keep it in that direction and maybe keep the EU on another path, possibly?
I don't have a lot of specific information, but my gut feeling is that the Brexit is actually could potentially make things worse. The EU is doing some bad things, but they also have a lot of, they also value privacy, and it's more explicitly written into their charters than it is in our Bill of Rights. It's very explicit, and they have some very strong protections. So I think it weighs heavily on their conscience. I'm really concerned that as we go down the Brexit path, that the UK is actually going to become worse than it would have been if it had stayed in.
That's my opinion too.
We're really worried about that. And if you look at the kind of motivations that brought that on, those motivations are probably lead you down into a darker path towards security being the top value of the culture everywhere. And if that's the top value, it means that liberty, freedom, privacy, those sorts of things get left by the wayside. So it's really very troubling. The Brexit itself is troubling. And this UK investigatory powers bill and where it could lead beyond that is even more troubling to me.
The UK is already not a model for civil liberties. I mean, if they have cameras everywhere, I mean, they're huge. I can't imagine why. That's why it's a little bit stupefying to me, because it's like they want even more power. I mean, the places, Andrew will be able to talk a bit about this.
Yeah. But,
they have cameras everywhere. They have they're already bulk data sets. It recently came out that they've been collecting bulk data sets since like 96, I think. Basically, bulk data sets involve, or they have the ability to. Again, it's signed by some high up official, but he just has to sign off that it's proportional and necessary. But bulk data sets involve metadata, essentially, about your travel, which institutions you bank at, who you're communicating with, anything that, metadata about your day-to-day life, they've just been collecting when the or whoever signs off on it, basically. So this, in a way, would codify that. So the UK bill would actually codify that and formalize that in a broader, applicability, and they could just do it, and then they would have to still have to get a warrant to search the information. But so all your information is being collected, but does that make you feel comfortable that they have everything, and then they just have to get a warrant or someone to sign off on it to search it? That doesn't make me feel comfortable, that it's not going to be misused or whatever. So, and there have been a lot of examples of it being misused. But just to give you another idea, when they're talking about browsing history, you know, Theresa May came out, and she's the head of the, yeah, over there, and she says, oh, it's not your browsing, it's not everything, every web page you visit or anything like that, but it is the sites you go to. So the distinction she's making is that, for example, if you go to CNN.com, that would be included in the internet information that they give or that they get. But if you go to a specific page on about a specific article, it wouldn't. So CNN.com is metadata under their definitions, but that CNN.com/whatever HTML address for a news article on a specific topic would not be, that would be content. So that's sort of a, in my opinion, a cop-out. I mean, you could tell a lot of information about someone just based on the domain they go to. So I think moving forward, you're going to see a lot more discussion about, you know, metadata versus content. And, you know, the ongoing debate has been whether metadata equals content, at what point. If you keep collecting metadata, enough metadata, it creates a picture of someone's life. So, and there's just not a lot of legislation on that, not a lot of protective legislation on that issue. So, yeah, this bill is, I have a feeling it's going to be heavily modified, at least in the public version of it. The intelligence agencies, they have other authorities that they've been using, like Snowden documents have released, you know, revealed, like Tempora, which is a full uptake system. They maintain all this information on people. They have certain rules of whether someone's a U.S. citizen or not, or excuse me, U.K. citizen or not. However, if they can't determine if you're a UK citizen, then they just collect it anyways. So anyone using anonymizing Tor, it's collected. You know, anyone, you know, if you're a UK citizen, you have certain rights, but you should have the right to anonymously communicate online, I would think. So anyhow, it goes back to the problem of mass surveillance, I think. What do you think, Scott?
Well, let's assume for a moment that it was passed in its draft form, you know, as it was today. I mean, the next step is that when people realize they're being surveilled all the time, they're going to use more anti-surveillance technology. So I'm sure that this would create a sense of crisis in the Home Office and in the government that they need to take the next legislative step and crack down on VPN or crack down on Tor or something like that. And then you see an endless cycle of more regulation followed by new technology that works around the regulation followed by more regulation on that technology, and the question is, where does it end? So I think that when the legislators are crafting these policies, they need to realize that this is the inevitable result of the policies. If you can extrapolate and you can say that this is, in a sense, this doesn't really solve the problem. I think they're fooling themselves into believing that this legislative approach will solve their problems, and they don't realize that they're opening a can of worms with the next generation of technology that's going to try to work around it.
Another interesting aspect of the bill was the equipment interference, which basically the bill would allow them to apply for a warrant to hack someone's device, or not even a warrant, just, you know, it's necessary and proportional, according to the secretary and this FISA-ish court judge official. So that's sort of unprecedented as well.
I mean, so that's without a warrant?
Yeah, as far as I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does that have any parameters defined as to equipment? Is that just their laptops, or are you talking routers?
Looking here on the... This is the UK government's fact sheet. So I have a bunch of these. This is their PR campaign about the legislation. So, here, sir, I'd like to hand that to you. If you all want to look at that, there's some key points in there. But it definitely would apply to cell phones. They've discussed that, but I assume it would just apply to to any computer or device, you know, whether it's a router, whether it's a cell phone, whether it's a computer. So if you're doing something the government finds suspicious, they could sign off on it, and your home computer could be hacked. That's essentially what that is. Again, that's the original version of the bill. We'll see what happens. But EI operations, equipment interference operations, may involve remotely installing a piece of software onto a device. So, currently, the Secretary of State issues warrants considering the necessity and proportionality of the need to use investigatory powers. So technically, it's a warrant, but I guess it's not a warrant in the sense that a judicial officer would issue it like the United States. So the Secretary of State issues the warrant, and then they're proposing a double lock authorization, which would require a judicial commissioner to sign off on it. So basically, one guy in the same fraternity as the other guy signs off on his buddy's thing. You can imagine, I mean, if you know anything about human nature and how governments work sometimes, a lot of the times you get very incestuous sort of relationships where there's no real opposing viewpoints when there should be on these issues. So that's a big risk. There needs to be more transparency with that. Yeah. Already covered that. They'd be required to keep records for 12 months.
It's interesting because I think the bill doesn't necessarily anticipate the potential impact of open source software. This is kind of today's smartphones Android. I mean, you can get an open source version of Android, but today's smartphone environments are pretty much closed environments. But this could a bill of this sort could potentially spur an interest in open source mobile devices, open source phones, where you just buy a piece of hardware and then you go out and load the operating system of your choice on there. And if you feel like that you've been potentially compromised, you can just go out and wipe the device and put another operating system of your choice on the device. So today you're very dependent on the hardware manufacturer for the software. This kind of thing, maybe in the future, the hardware and software may kind of split, and you may go kind of just go out to the internet and pick and choose what kind of software you want in the future. This is another thing that I don't think that they've anticipated in this bill. They've written it for the technology of today, and that could change very quickly. It could pivot very quickly if there's sort of a chilling environment created by this bill. And one particular answer is to redesign the mobile phone to be more amenable to open source. Even more so than Android, way above and beyond Android, where you're basically going out and running your own mini version of Linux or something like that. And obviously not everybody's going to do that, but it could open the door for that. And if that happens, you know, you have some greater sense of assurance about what's really running and what's not running on your mobile phone. And, you know, if you're concerned that it's using up the battery twice as fast as it used to, I wonder if it's running a spy program. You'll have a greater access to software that could go in and look at it at a deeper level than you can. For Apple in particular, today is a very locked down environment, and you really can't go out and just get software that looks down at a very deep level and tries to figure out, is there some kind of spyware running on this? So that there's good things and bad things about today's Apple, today's iOS. It is a lockdown and more secure environment, but it's also harder to bring in a third-party tool that would look deeper into the device and see if there's some kind of spyware running. And I think that this bill is written, the bill is obviously written for the technology of today, and the technology could pivot very quickly to kind of route around some of the more chilling effects of it. But of course, then regulators can come back with their phase two. So it becomes maybe kind of like a never-ending battle. So I think one of the reasons to oppose some of this at this point is to kind of anticipate this back and forth struggle that could occur between the law and the technology. And I think that if you inject some reasonableness into the debate at this point, you would prevent these back and forth struggles down the road.
I agree. That's why we're here, hopefully. Here's another talking point from their fact sheet here. It says communications data, CD. It says provides judicial authorization for requests by public authorities acquiring communications data to identify or confirm a journalistic source. So that's directly on their fact sheet. So that's been another, here, you seem interested in this. I'm not lying, that's right on there. So it's just blatant, in my opinion, a lot of the stuff. It's sort of like their campaign to push this legislation is shock and awe, sort of throw out the worst version first, and then once we have a chance to process it and they'll concede a little bit, but they'll still get a vast majority of what they want, maybe. I say screw that. I say we oppose it and defeat the whole entire thing and make them rewrite it from the ground up responsibly with our input, kind of a mindset. But the issue about how it relates to the United States is that the United States and the UK are part of this Five Eyes network, which the Snowden documents released or disclosed. And there's a lot of information sharing. So the way it's set up right now is that the UK and United States can query a lot of the same databases. There's a database called XKeyscore that the UK can query that has information that we have obtained. Who here is not that familiar at all with the Five Eyes or Snowden and all that? Is anyone? Who is familiar? Okay, all right, so. Basically what happened is that when Snowden released all these documents, one of the main things he disclosed was this XKeyscore program, which is essentially the front end. Scott might be able to explain a little better, but it's a front end, which is like a search engine that brings together all the data that we accumulate, and it's not only our data, but it's data from other countries, the Five Eyes, which I believe are like Australia, UK, and we share that information with other countries. So if the UK law says we're going to lessen our data restrictions on collecting data, and we can collect all this information on people outside the UK, well, that means they can collect information that routes these cables in international waters. So a lot of our information transits those international cables, because when you email someone, even if it's domestically, the data could flow outside the United States, go through these different cables, and it may go a different way the next time you do it. So unless you can distinguish yourself or as a US citizen or UK citizen, you're just going to be swept up in this dragnet surveillance, and then you're going to be put into this database along with your metadata and the content. UK has a Tempora system which collects content, retains it for 30 days, and then purges out the stuff it's certain it doesn't need, and then it holds on to stuff it may need in the future, just because they can't store everything. But that's just going to go into a database, and then it could be searched according to these authorities that the UK bill is proposing. And they explicitly set out that the government can search these things and collect information on people outside of the UK. So there really needs to be an international consensus. It's, if one country does one thing, it sort of creates a race to the bottom mentality, where if one country's doing it, we need to do it. We're going to be at a disadvantage. It seems similar to me as sort of like taxation, where if you have a lower tax bracket or you give favorable treatment, the company's going to move to a different location. So in that way, it's sort of like we have to have a consensus to combat this risk of going down that path, like Scott says. So,
yeah, so even if you think this is a UK-only matter, we are really all in this together. All these systems are tied together, and it does hurt us. Even if we didn't pass anything like this at all, it still is going to hurt us down the road.
Any questions?
Anything else you wanted to cover?
Any personal surveillance stories? Anyone worried that they're being followed right now?
Are you understanding the concerns that we're bringing up? Is that making sense to you?
I have a story I'd like to tell since we have some time. When I was in college, I got out of the military in 2000. Right, Mom? And I went into college. I went to Washington State University, and I think it was my second year there. It was after the September 11th attacks. And I was downstairs in the rec center. They had a rec center there, and I was playing pool. I used to be a big pool player, billiards, whatever. And two guys approached me. I was playing pool with them for a while, and I was talking with them. They're cool guys. You know, a little bit older than me, but whatever. And so they go, hey, can we talk to you for a second? And I thought that, I was like, that's strange. So I'm like, okay. And they go, well, come over here. And there was a little alcove where it was kind of behind some pop machines. We call it pop in Washington, not soda or Coke here. But anyway, there were some pop machines. And so we went behind those. And a guy flips out as an FBI agent. And so he asked me, basically the gist of the conversation, you know, was that we want you to, you know, give us some information and go around to these different groups. And, you know, nothing formal, nothing too, you know, invasive or anything, you know, just license plate numbers, people who go to these certain meetings, whatnot. And he says, you can't tell anyone we had this conversation. Now here's my card, and think about it and let me know. Pardon? You can leave it rolling. By now they know my opinion on this situation. I'm sure they have it somewhere in their file. This guy declined. He's a insurgent or something. But anyhow, I declined, and basically he said, you cannot call anyone. You can't tell anyone or anything about what my offer or this situation, but think about it and let us know. Well, I called one person. I think it was grandma or something. And I called one person, just one person. Maybe that was a test. They told me explicitly not to talk to anyone. But anyhow, I called the number he gave me, and I was going to decline formally, but no one answered, and I never got a call back from him. So maybe they knew I called someone. That was a test or something. I don't know. But at any rate, it was kind of an eye-opener to me. You know, stuff like that happens. So, I mean, I was in the FBI panel, FBI versus Apple panel the other day. First question I asked was like, is there anyone here from the FBI? Anyone? Because that happens. There are FBI agents that will attend stuff like this. So you kind of have to disabuse yourself of the idea that the government doesn't do those types of things. And if you know a little bit about history and, you know, they didn't get that much of detail. But, yeah, unfortunately, I didn't learn that much detail about that. Yeah.
It just came out in the paper probably 2 months ago that FBI has been going Burning Man for the last several years. And that was freely admitted that they've been doing that.
Yeah, anytime you have interesting ideas and people and there's a social atmosphere, I kind of play devil's advocate in my own mind sometimes. I try to understand why they do these things. You know, so I kind of role play, brainstorm. So, yeah, my thought is anytime you have interesting ideas and people, they want to understand trends. They want to understand what motivates people. They want to sort of control and understand. And, you know, that runs against some core beliefs about human nature, I think, are valuable. You know, self-determination, freedom, free will, that kind of thing. So that's really kind of what all this whole debate comes down to, in my opinion, is like, how do we preserve those values in this new era of technology and all these cool advances in technology we have? We like playing Pokemon Go and all this stuff, but you know, it comes at a cost, and we need to raise awareness about it. So, but that's interesting that they went to Burning Man. That doesn't surprise me at all, though.
The article said that they had new surveillance technology that they were testing, and they kind of viewed that as an ideal place to go try it out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they got in trouble. I think it was the FBI got in trouble 1 year because they monitored the communications of the whole entire city where a Super Bowl was held or something. I don't remember exactly what year, but they monitored everyone. It was like the first time they did it as like a test to see what, like, I assume to see what the data would look like coming in, whether it would be useful. See all the trends, all the communications, all the location of all the cell phones, everything, like just testing, you know, the capability of something, you know, as a practical matter. So, I mean, stuff happens all the time. You hear about protests being monitored, Black Lives Matter stuff. What is it? The what's that one? 99% movement. You know what I'm talking? Occupy Wall Street. Stories come out about FBI surveillance there as well. Stingray devices being used to simulate cell towers monitoring location of everyone. I mean, there are data. I mean, there are algorithms they will use to map people's locations, and they're based on their metadata. These graphical things where they can see if the relationship structure changes, they can glean information about people's ideas changes, predict a protest, predict violence or whatever. So it gets really, really technical when they have access to all this data. And
if you're heading out to a protest, there's this wonderful thing on your phone called airplane mode.
I haven't heard about that.
You can kind of go in stealth.
Yeah, the FBI, I think, or was it the, I think it was the FBI, they broke the Tor network, and they were able to identify this pedophile ring, apparently, based off research from a university. They had farmed out, or someone had sold them the information, and they'd used a private entity, or outside government, because university isn't private, but they have the money, so it's really hard to turn down when you see a government project that says, oh, help us in this benign issue, look at all this money we'll give you. And so a lot of the times that the moral, the ethical issues just causes people to gloss over. It's like money, money, money. So it, you know, it's important to stop and think about these issues.
And the government by and large isn't governments by and large aren't building their own technologies, but in the wake of 9/11 a lot of money was poured into the technology sector. And there is some good law enforcement technology out there, but there's also a lot of snake oil, and there's sort of a gold rush into this area. A lot of the companies, you know, it's not incumbent on the companies when they're building a new surveillance product to ask themselves, are they compliant with the Bill of Rights or not? They're just out there to sell the stuff. And they're not accountable in the same way that the government is. It's ultimately the government that does the operation and is accountable. But there's a lot of technology out there, and it is getting a little off topic, but it is sort of on topic too. There's a lot of technology out there where the freedom of speech, privacy, or the Bill of Rights is an afterthought, because they're just out there to sell product. And this is the kind of thing that can get the kind of products that can get sold back into a government, whether it's UK or US or whatever. There's been a gold rush into surveillance technology, and it's creating it's moving a lot faster than the laws are moving. Even if the laws seem to be moving quickly, this technology is moving more quickly. When you hear about that Burning Man situation, I have no way of knowing exactly, but I'll bet you that it's some kind of new product that somebody sold them, and they're testing it. Whether it is Bill of Rights compliant or not, it probably isn't, because it's not incumbent on the technology provider to adhere to the Bill of Rights. But you know, when you hear about the government testing technology, they're almost certainly testing third-party technology, because they're generally not, you know, they're really not an in-house technology shop.
Yeah, I think we're almost done here.
One
final thought. My main beef is not with the FBI doing their job. It's just to make sure that throughout the process, you know, the inherently good human qualities are preserved and discussed, and there's an ongoing debate. I just don't like the idea that all this stuff's being decided in private, and then citizens are forced to challenge it in court, but it's extremely cost prohibited. You know, it's a problem, because if you challenge it, you're going to spend, I think we talked about NSLs, it took 11 years to challenge the redaction of one page of an NSL. So
Yeah, and there just seems to be an endless ocean of unintended consequences from these kind of bills, and that's troubling. So, you know, you'll want to see the technology people get involved in the process, and help us through, help us understand that the legislators can tend to have a very simple-minded approach, and really have just they're just not well equipped to consider even the slightest possible unintended consequence coming from this. But there's certainly to be unintended consequences coming from this kind of measure.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks.
On Sunday morning. Y'all can contact me. I'll give you an hour of free legal advice.
One hour.
Just mention this panel.